Chapter 43. The Oval Office, the White House. After the curved door to the Oval Office closes, leaving the four of them alone, Samantha Keating looks at the angry faces of President Barnes and Barnes's husband, the chief of staff, and says, "Well, anybody want to answer my question? Do Matt and I have anything to fear?" With anger in his voice, Richard Barnes says, "Mrs. Keating, with all due respect, I can't believe you've just said that." "Richard," she says, feeling her face warm, "you and I and everyone else in this room have gone through the fires, the double talk, the betrayals to get here. We all have a lot more in common than we like to admit. There are no innocents here. What I asked was a legitimate question. Can you answer it?" She takes a breath. The memories of her time in this horrid place, the compromises, the arguments, the betrayals, are coming up to the surface. She tried so very hard to bury it all when she walked out of here 2 Januaries ago. Before her are the man and woman who years back chose to betray the trust of her husband and to force him out of office. It all comes back. Samantha continues, "For the past year and a half, I've been back in the real world, working with students who worry about their loans, their grades, and how they'll get a job after they graduate. It's been refreshing as hell being among people who don't care about polls, focus groups, and who's up over someone else. I can trust them. Can Matt and I trust you?" President Barnes leans forward and, with a soft voice, says, "Samantha, please, believe me when I say this. The entire force of the federal government is going to work as one to find Mel and bring her back safely." Matt squeezes Samantha's hand but stays quiet. Samantha says, "All right then." She keeps her voice controlled. "Despite my detours into politics, at heart I'm just a college professor. I don't deal with speculation, only facts. And I wanted it out here, in this room, that despite the efforts of that son of a bitch, Asim al-Rashid, Matt and I have nothing to fear from this administration." The president's husband and chief of staff says, "No bullshit, Mrs. Keating. You and your husband should have no concerns. We have this. We won't let you down. I give you my word." She nearly has to bite her tongue and then shakes her head. "Your word?" She looks up at him. "All right, Richard. Your word it is." Something in his eyes tells her she's struck home. And a memory from more than 2 years ago comes to her like an old nightmare that just won't die, even in the middle of a sunlit day. At that time, she was working late in her offices in the East Wing when an unexpected visitor came by, ushered in by her chief of staff, June Walters, whom Samantha knows was secretly rooting for Matt's vice president to defeat him at the upcoming convention. Her visitor had made himself known at a Secret Service kiosk at the Northeast Gate, and once his name had been passed along to Samantha, she made the necessary arrangements. She smiled at seeing the familiar young man come in, dressed casually in jeans, dark green t-shirt, and short leather jacket. Samantha got up from behind her disorganized desk. She had been trying to juggle her own schedule and the ravenous needs of the committee to re-elect Matthew Keating, and offered a hand. "Carl," she said. "What a nice surprise." "Thanks, Professor," Carl Sanchez said, taking a chair after giving her hand a brief shake. When she was teaching at Stanford, he had been one of her smartest and most capable grad students, and she had written one of her best letters of recommendation for him when he graduated. Samantha waved a hand and went back to her desk and said, "Not a professor at the moment, Carl. I'm the First Lady of the Nation. And most days I wish I was back in California. And you? Please tell me you're at some school teaching freshmen and overseeing a dig somewhere." Carl shook his head. "Didn't work out, Professor. Mrs. Keating." "Please," she said. "Enough time has passed. It's Samantha." A knowing shrug. "You know how it is. Too many applicants. Too few openings. Colleges cutting back on salaries. Pouring money into administrators and fancy dining halls. Taught a few semesters as an adjunct. And at my last job, I was living in the back of my car and taking showers at the gym. decided then to make a career change and started working for my uncle. He runs a security firm. Good pay, nice bennies, some travel. Samantha recalled the great papers and projects Carl had produced back at Stanford, focusing on the forgotten history of overlooked Native American tribes from Siskiyou County, and she thought, what a shame. And now? He said, I won't waste your time, Samantha. It's like this. A few months ago, I was in Macau overseeing the update of a security system my uncle's company had installed at a new hotel and casino there. The Golden Palace Macau, very high priced, designed for what they call whales, high rollers. Samantha saw a nervous flicker in Carl's eyes, but like a good teacher who knew her student was about to say something important, she kept her mouth closed. Go on, was all she said. Carl rubbed both hands on his legs, drew a deep breath. I was working in the security ops center at 2 a.m, drinking lousy coffee, trying to debug a system, and keeping an eye on some of the CCTV feeds. I mean, those whales and others that can afford portable jamming systems don't know their systems don't work with what the Chinese have in their back pockets. Samantha said, what did you see? Someone I shouldn't have seen? Who? He glanced around her cluttered office as if he couldn't look her in the eye. The vice president's husband. That cowboy from Florida. The one who sold some of his farmland a while back for a casino. Richard Barnes? Carl looked down at the carpet. Yeah, but he wasn't alone. It was, okay, I don't want to say it aloud. He wasn't by himself. You see what I mean? Something that's illegal in most countries. Samantha felt as though all the coffee she'd drunk to keep her awake was about to crawl out of her churning stomach. Carl stood up. I don't like him, and I don't like his wife, and I don't like what they're both doing to your husband. That's not right. He reached into his pocket, took out a small rectangular piece of black plastic, gently put it on top of a pile of papers. This is for you. Samantha stared at it as if it were a scorpion or some other stinging insect. What's that, Carl? He started to leave her office. That's a thumb drive with a recording of the vice president's hubby over in Macau, thousands of miles away from his wife and his country, thinking he can't possibly get caught. And Professor Keating, use that video at the right time and your husband can't lose. I erased the source recording so the Chinese don't have it. Only you. He slipped out of her office and she didn't say a word, just stared at that little piece of metal and plastic. Outside the Oval Office, she's walking with Matt down one of the historic and well-furnished hallways in this place that was once their home. And she says, Matt, I'm sorry I lost it back there. Matt takes her hand, holds it tight. Around them are Secret Service agents, staff members to this administration. And as she stiffly walks down this familiar corridor, she whispers, Oh, Matt, where is she? One thing she learned a long time ago is to never ever let them, including your own staff, see you sweat or lose your cool in public because gossip and leaks can get out there to the media and the ravenous blogs. Nevertheless, she wipes at her eyes with her free hand and the tears just erupt. Within a second, Matt is hugging her hard. And she buries her face in his shoulder and the tears really flow and she's thinking that her daughter, their girl, is being held by a monster who can kill with such ease and pleasure. Matt whispers, thousands of people across the country, Sam, are looking for Mel right now. We're not alone. We're going to get her back. I promise. We're going to get her back. And she slips and whispers, Oh, Matt, it's my fault. My fault. He gently breaks free, strokes her hair, kisses her forehead, and says, Sam, it's not your fault. How can you say that? It's not your fault. She bites her lower lip and peers over his shoulder, noticing the staff in Secret Service doing their best not to look at them, and thinks, But it is my fault, Matt. I had the key to your re-election win in my hand. the thumb drive with Richard Barnes's perversions recorded, and I didn't use it. I couldn't use it. And I wouldn't use it. Samantha wipes at her eyes, tries to smile at her strong and troubled husband. I know it's just so much. But she's thinking, no, back then, Matt, I didn't want you to win. I wanted to leave this horrible town and build a new life for us. And it's my fault you didn't win re-election. If you had won, we'd still be here in the White House with all the protection, and Mel would be safe. All right? Matt asks with concern. She nods, tears still in her eyes. Enough. Let's get back to the hotel.
Chapter 44. Northwestern New Hampshire. Mel Keating is sitting on the edge of her well-made bed in her concrete cell, ready to escape, ready to humiliate her kidnappers. Her first meal of the day was some sort of chicken and rice dish, served on a paper plate with a spoon and a red plastic cup of water. But when she sipped the water, she found that her kidnappers had accidentally given her two plastic cups, one nestled in the other. She slipped out the spare cup and hid it under her bedding, and was sitting politely and quietly when the younger man, called Faraj, came in to pick up the dishes. A mistake. They gave her something extra, and she is going to use that to her advantage. She remembers again the briefing she received from Agent Stahl during those weird, busy few weeks when she and Mom and Dad moved into the White House. Secret Service Agent David Stahl was sitting in a plain wooden chair in her new bedroom at the White House and said with a quiet yet firm voice, "And another thing, Mel, if you're kidnapped, the first hours are the most important." "Why is that?" she asked, still trying to grasp that this was all real, that she was no longer living at the Naval Observatory with Mom and Dad, that Dad was really the president, and now she was living in the White House. Unbelievable. Agent Stahl said, "The first few minutes, the first few hours, it's a time of flux. Your captors will be nervous, high-strung, trying to adjust to what they've just done. That's when you should grab any chance to escape. A day or two later, they've settled into a routine. They've set up the watch schedule. You're their prisoner. It'll be too late by then. The first few hours, that's your gift. Use it." She nodded, scared by what he was saying, but still trying to take it all in. She was now the president's daughter. "Mel," Agent Stahl said, "any questions?" "No," she said, "not now." He smiled. "Don't worry. The chances of this happening are infinitesimally small, but it's good to be prepared." She wanted to laugh or joke at the thought of being kidnapped, but the hard look in that Secret Service agent's eyes, so much like Dad's, kept her mouth shut. Mel hears the door being unlocked, takes a breath, takes her glasses off with one hand, and again rubs her eyes hard, pinches at her cheeks, gets the tears rolling. The glasses go back on with her free hand. "Be prepared," she remembers. "The first few hours, that's your gift. Use it." The door swings open, and it's the younger of the two again, Faraj. He steps in, holding a yellow plastic tray with a covered dish and another red plastic cup. He's dressed in jeans and a checked flannel shirt, and a holstered pistol is at his right side. He steps toward her, and Mel coughs, chokes, and does her best to start crying, saying, "Please, I'm so scared. Won't you let me free? Please? I'll make sure my daddy gives you a reward." Faraj sneers at her, and Mel thinks, "Just two more steps. Just two more steps, and I'll wipe that damn sneer off your face, jerk." Faraj al-Ashid comes closer to the weeping little baby girl and thinks, "What a spoiled brat. What a fool. Her entire pleasured life is ahead of her, and she cries like someone who has lost a dolly. Her life has been pampered and safe. no worries of missed meals, or thirst, or ragged clothes, or the sudden explosion of a bomb falling from the sky. And for him, once, years ago, Faraj had a chance to escape the squabbling militias and tribes around Tripoli, and he went to Paris, and through luck and connections, actually spent 2 semesters on scholarship at film school
at the École Internationale de Création Audiovisuelle et de Réalisation,
learning filmmaking and special effects, and wanting to create movies. And Faraj says, "Stop crying, little girl. You're..." She stands up and tosses some liquid in his eyes, burning them. Mel yells, "I'm not a little girl!" as she tosses the foul liquid in the red plastic cup, a mixture of the chemical fluid in the toilet and, ugh, her own pee at the creep's face. But the stuff works as the man yelps and drops the tray and stumbles back. Mel doesn't hesitate and tosses a hard kick right into the kidnapper's crotch. He yelps something sharp in Arabic, doubles over, and Mel tugs the 9mm pistol out of his holster. "Don't move!" she yells, as she tries to go around him to that beautiful open door, but the jerk moves forward, trying to block her. "I warned you," she thinks, as she pulls the hammer back on the pistol and smoothly and quickly pulls the trigger. Chapter 45. Northwestern New Hampshire. The click of the hammer snapping down on the pistol stuns Mel, and with practiced ease, from many trips to the range with her dad, she quickly works the action of the pistol, trying to clear any possible jam, and once again, click. Faraj stands up, grinning, eyes half closed, and he tugs at the hem of his flannel shirt, brings it up to wipe at his eyes, and Mel throws the useless pistol at that smiling bastard, slips past his hands, and bumps right into Asim al-Ashid. He seizes her throat with a strong right hand, starts squeezing. Mel can't breathe, can't scream. She flails at his arms and strong chest and face, and he comes back into her cell, pushes her down on the bed. Mel gasps, chokes, and brings her hands up to her pained throat. A bout of coughing doubles her over, and the fake tears from earlier are replaced by real ones. Asim stands over her, and in a slow and menacing tone says, "Stupid child, do you really think I would allow my cousin in here with a loaded weapon? Do you?" Faraj is standing next to Asim, smiling though his eyes are reddened. Asim says, "We know so much about you. How you were raised, how you were taught. We know you are not uncomfortable around firearms. We know you lied earlier. Having my cousin appear to be armed was a ploy. Yes, a ploy to give you hope, to make you feel like you had a chance. And it worked. Now you know, Mal Keating, deep within everything inside of you, that you cannot escape, that you will never escape, and that you belong to us in life or death." The tears come quicker, and Mel has to look away. "Forever," he says.
Asim says a few words in Arabic, and Faraj returns with a metal folding chair. Asim sits down, giving Mel Keating a good, steady look. He is pleased at how well everything has proceeded, pleased at how well his plan has worked out. At some point, she was going to try to grab Faraj's pistol and escape. He's just a bit surprised at how quickly she has done it. Mel stops weeping, takes her glasses off, rubs at her eyes, and then stares at Asim. Not with fear or sadness, but with defiance. Seeing this young girl's determined face stabs at him, reminds him of his oldest daughter, Amina, who was nearly this girl's age. There is nothing the same about them, from their hair to their complexions, but the fierceness in their eyes. Amina was a good daughter, and always one to obey her mother and help in the kitchen and with the laundry. but there was always a simmering defiance in those eyes, like in those of this young lady in front of him, in his possession. Asim says, "Why do you think you are here?" Mel folds her arms. "You like blonde chicks?" He restrains himself, for hearing those words makes him want to slap that face hard, leave a bruise on a cheek, a split lip, blood trickling down. Asim says, "Because you're a prisoner of war, that is why. A war that has been going on for centuries." Mel shrugs. "What, you're going to give me a lecture on the clash of civilizations? West versus East? Islam versus Christianity? The works of Samuel Huntington, pro and con? Please, I've heard it before, from professionals who know a hell of a lot more about it than you." Asim clenches his fists. "Academics, weak men, book learners. I knew them well when I was your age and was at university, before jihad called me away. What do they know about war?" "War?" the president's daughter snaps back. "Some war you've got there, beheading innocents, blowing up shopping malls, taking a machine gun out and shooting up a street in Paris. I'm sure years from now poets will be singing the praises of your courage, facing the unarmed and the crying children." "What do you know of war?" he says, struggling to keep his voice even. "Plenty," she says. "Or have you already forgotten who my dad is and what he did before becoming a congressman?"
"Your father," Asim spits out.
"You talk about brave warriors. He and his ilk, heavily armored, connected to the internet, being able to view a battleground thanks to your satellites and surveillance drones. What chance do any warriors such as myself have against such overwhelming technology and arms?" The young girl with the reddened eyes doesn't waver.
"Setting fire to a daycare center, killing children who barely know how to walk and speak. That's some warrior."
Asim says, "Yes, as grim as it is a warrior's action. Look to yourself. Look to your father when he was president. When a drone is fired and misses a target and obliterates a wedding party, how long do you mourn for the innocents? How much do you demand an investigation into what happened? Or if a scared American soldier in a foreign land faces an approaching van that doesn't stop in time, and he machine guns the father and mother and children inside, how much do you care?" "No, Mel Keating, you and the rest of your people just shrug your shoulders, go to your cell phone screens, and don't pay it any attention." She starts to reply, but Asim talks over her, waving a hand about the concrete cell. "Such a rich, fortunate, fat, corrupt, and godless country. How would you feel? How would you react, Mel Keating, if these lands were so rich yet so weak that powers from abroad felt free to roam this land with ease, installing and deposing your state governors at will, killing civilians all in the name of what they feel is holy? How would you feel?" There's a waver in her previously strong eyes. Asim feels that finally he is penetrating her smug assurance. He says, "I'll tell you how you would feel. You would feel oppressed, ground down, and you and your fellow people would take up arms to force these foreigners from your lands, no matter the cost, no matter the blood spilt." Mel clears her throat.
"That's just a simple explanation, that's all."
Asim gets up. "You and your people should have followed the philosophy of your sixth president. He was a wise man." Mel doesn't say anything. Asim smiles.
"Confused, young girl. You dare to lecture me on my history and beliefs, and yet the mention of your sixth president leaves you clueless? I will help you. He was John Quincy Adams, and he once said, 'Americans should not go abroad to slay dragons they do not understand in the name of spreading democracy.' Understand now? You have traveled and reached across the globe to slay dragons. Don't be surprised when the dragons return the favor."
Mel squeezes her arms tighter. Asim says, "Consider yourself fortunate. At any other place or time, a captor who had attacked my cousin would have been severely punished, in a creative and bloody way. But for you, Mel Keating, the president's daughter, my only punishment is this." He gestures to the floor, where the spilt food and paper plate and plasticware are scattered. "Here is your evening meal. You will have to eat off the floor, like so many people displaced by your government are forced to do." Asim turns and walks away.
And Mel says, "Please, you said something before. What did you mean? About keeping me forever? Why did you say that? Didn't you make a ransom demand? Won't you let me go if the demand is met?"
He types in the keypad code that unlocks the door, turns to her with a wide smile.
"You are an educated young lady. I'm sure you'll figure out what forever means."
Chapter 46. Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. Thanks to the efforts of my highly skilled and somewhat scary chief of staff, Madeline Perry, my wife Samantha and I are keeping watch in the second connected suite at the Saunders Hotel. The room is cluttered with barely touched room service trays of food. CNN is on the TV with the volume turned down, and Samantha is on one of the two beds, curled up, watching silently as the correspondents and experts on the screen talk to each other and the millions of people watching. I turned down the volume about a half hour ago, after some alleged expert on hostage-taking and kidnapping smugly said that in all likelihood, our daughter was already dead. And Samantha cried out, and it was a race between me and Agent Stahl to turn down the damn TV. I kept my mouth shut, but I made a note of the man's name, knowing that somehow, somewhere, he and I would have an interesting meeting one of these days. I'm pacing around the large suite like the proverbial caged animal, and it's the damn helplessness that's killing me. When I was in the teams, there was training, planning, more training, and then execution. As a congressman, vice president, and then POTUS, I at least had the illusion that I could make decisions and choices, and most times they were followed through with as they filtered down through the bureaucracy. Now, I'm dependent on other people for the safety of my daughter, and I'm hating every dark and frightening second. I see my go bag in the corner and nearly laugh at the pathetic black canvas case. Inside are weapons and ammunition ready for what? To fly back to New Hampshire and blindly go into the woods and start hunting? I can hear phones ringing and muffled voices from the other attached suite where Madeline Perry is keeping a tight control on matters, and I need to continue to trust her. She will come in here if there's a development or if a decision has to be made. I look to my wife. Her eyes are closed. She seems to be dozing. Agent Stahl is working on a laptop. Me? Apparently useless. I let a second or two pass and then whisper, "Man up, Buttercup." If any of my past team members could magically be here, they would be shocked at what I'm doing, which is nothing. The drapes are pulled, and I look over at the screen, and CNN is broadcasting a shot of traffic backing up at some checkpoint on a rural road in New Hampshire. Time to change that equation. I go to a corner of the large suite where there's a work area with a table and chairs, and I take out my iPhone and get to work. First call is to Sarah Palumbo, the Deputy National Security Advisor for the National Security Council, who warned me hours and a lifetime ago about the president's daily brief that indicated I was the target of increased terrorist chatter and interest. Sure. Like many intelligence analyses, it was generally accurate, but not specific enough. They were coming for me, all right, by kidnapping Mel. The phone rings once, then rings and rings and goes to voicemail. "This is Palumbo," says the familiar voice. "You know the drill." I say, "Sarah, Matt Keating here. Please call me back when you can. Thanks." I disconnect the call. Who next? I could call others I know in D.C. law enforcement and the military who are going all out in trying to find Mel, but what would I accomplish except for distracting them from their work and maybe angering President Barnes and her people at a time when I can't afford to do that? Time to go overseas. I check the time, surprised to see we're now in the morning hours. But I really shouldn't be surprised. When I was with the teams in the middle of planning or conducting an op, I could easily get by on 4 hours of sleep a day, and Lord knows I'm in the middle of one right now. I have two calls to make and decide to make the hard one first. As a congressman, vice president, and president, I met scores of foreign leaders, military and intelligence personnel, and assorted aides and advisors to the same. Most I met for a grip and a grin in my office, or later the Oval Office, and that's it. But sometimes, there's a connection, a quick realization that you could do business with this man or woman in a foreign government who knows matters and knows how to get things done. That leads to back channels, unofficial lines of communication, and negotiations with men and women you trust aren't bullshitting you. Like the man I'm dialing right now. The phone rings once and is picked up. Yes? I'm dreading this call, but I have to admit I'm happy it was answered. Ahmad? It's Matt Keating. A sigh from the other end of the call, somewhere in either the deserts or the air-conditioned high-rises of Saudi Arabia. Ah, Matt. My sympathies, Ahmad says in his cultured voice with a hint of a British accent. You know I give my best wishes to you and Samantha for the safe release of Melanie. Thank you, I say. For a few seconds, time passes slowly, as Ahmad, also known as Major General Ahmad bin Nayef, former deputy director of the General Intelligence Directorate of Saudi Arabia, makes me wait. Some years ago, when I was a simple congressman from Texas, I heard that one of Ahmad's sons, receiving flight training at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita County, was getting more than the usual hazing as the cliched Ferner. I put an end to that nonsense with one phone call to the base commandant and another to the Secretary of the Air Force. Ahmad, please, I say, I'm looking for any help you or your associates can give us. Us meaning you, Matt, or us meaning the United States? I clench my iPhone harder. Whichever can get my daughter back. Ah, well, that's posing a difficulty, as I'm sure you know, he says. President Barnes and her Secretary of State are not particularly liked in the kingdom. Their insistence that we change our government and way of life to what is seen in your Palm Beach County has not been well received. The CIA station chief and our FBI liaison have officially asked for our assistance, but many here in Riyadh have long memories and insulted pride. I'm sorry to say that will impact just how far we will go. I close my eyes, rub at them. As that wily old Henry Kissinger once said, America has no permanent friends or enemies, only interests. And since FDR agreed back in 1945 to provide military assistance to Saudi Arabia, that rich and troubling place has been one of our biggest interests in the Middle East. Do I and other previous presidents agree with everything they do? Of course not, especially when it comes to human rights. But they have a wide-ranging intelligence service, and although some in the kingdom have funneled money to terrorists around the world, others there, friends of the West, have funded important covert missions from us to the British or to the French to keep ahead of those who like to maim and kill innocents, like Asim. And when it came to bloody fights like the one to contain and crush ISIS, the Saudis were a vital and quiet ally. I know, Ahmad, I reply. And where I can, I've done my best to temper the Barnes administration's demands and proposals, but there's only so much I can do. I'm a former president, and I know what it's like to be ignored and belittled by the current administration. Ahmad, please, father to father, I'm seeking your help. And just like that, Ahmad says, then you will receive it, my friend. I've already made inquiries, but so far it's not been encouraging. This creature, Asim al-Rashid, he is even feared by our most hardened men in the kingdom. He takes too much pleasure in the killing, using the blessed words of the Prophet as a shield. He has many friends and assets in the network around the world. But I will tell you this, something that is troubling me. What is it, Ahmad? He says, your CIA and FBI, they have not pushed back where we have been taking our time, delaying. It's like they expected our resistance and decided that it was just fine. And that, Matt, frightens me for you almost as much as Asim al-Rashid.
Chapter 47 Williams Pond, Leah, New Hampshire. Jiang Lijun of the Chinese Ministry of State Security yawns again as the sun starts to make itself known through the peaks of this state's White Mountains. He waits in his rental GMC sedan in this dirt parking lot adjacent to a wide body of water in the northern part of this New Hampshire state. It took nearly every free second to plan and make this trip after meeting with his boss, Li Baodong. Jiang Lijun drove out to Newark and then took a flight to Montreal, and then drove a rental to Sherbrooke and then another rental to here, this small town. At the border crossing in Vermont, the line of cars and trucks going into Canada was at a crawl, as uniformed men with dogs seemed to search everybody and everything. On the ride down here, Black Hawk helicopters and other aircraft were a constant presence in the air, and twice he pulled over for roaring police cruisers coming up behind him with flashing lights and sirens. But now he waits for Asim al-Ashid to arrive. By slipping past his watchers and illegally traveling to Canada, and then illegally re-entering the United States, Jiang has violated numerous American diplomatic protocols for Chinese representatives, and he would be immediately expelled if caught. But so what? Just another trip across the tightrope. He yawns again, thinks of his wife, Jun, and how upset she was that he had to leave so unexpectedly. Jun is a smart woman, knows of Jiang's work, is employed at the mission as a clerical staff supervisor, and with their daughter, Li Na, in her arms, she said, "Do you really have to go?" At any other time, Jiang would have abruptly dismissed her, but the little form of their daughter and her sweet, innocent eyes, oh, that touched him. Maybe being a father was changing him. Was fieldwork like this still in his future? Earlier, Jiang had reached out to Asim and was pleased to see the despicable man's quick reply. The system to do so was simple and nearly untraceable. Years ago, when Jiang was controlling Asim in Libya, he had set up an anonymous email account through a Swiss-based company that offered the world's best secured encryption, and he shared the address and password with Asim. Using this shared account, they could leave messages in the email system's drafts folder without anyone, from the NSA to Great Britain's government communications headquarters, having a hint of what they were doing. Every 6 months or so, he would contact Asim just to keep that line of communication open. But the last email was the important one. It set up this meet. On the dashboard is a pack of Marlboro cigarettes. Time for a smoke. He smokes only Zhonghua's in his office at the New York Embassy. He gets out of the car and takes a good look at the pond and the small park. Already there are visitors, mostly fishermen and children. Two men are hunched over a picnic table with cups of coffee and breakfast pastries. Farther away, at another picnic table, children are squabbling with their parents. Filial piety. For these barbarians? Never. Ugh. To live in such an empty and wooded place. Years ago, dear mother cried when he left for his schooling in America. She thought he would never return. But she had nothing to worry about. At UCLA and then Columbia, where he got his master's degree in international affairs, he found the Americans lazy and unfocused, and while they droned on and on about freedom, the only freedom he and his fellow Chinese students experienced was the freedom of the Americans to lecture them. One day at lunch at the Ferris Booth Commons in Lerner Hall, an earnest woman grad student from Cambridge, the one in Massachusetts, not England, started lecturing him about Tiananmen. And she only shut up when he asked her if she had ever heard of the slaughters at Kent State and Jackson State. A black pickup truck rattles in and parks nearby. An old man, hunched over and holding a fishing pole, slowly steps out of the cab. He wears baggy jeans and a dirty yellow jacket, and a black knit cap is pulled over his head. Jiang reads the bumper stickers on the back of the truck. "Register criminals, not guns. Mologne, l'abbé. Come and get it. I fear my government." Jiang shakes his head. How this undisciplined rabble of a people got anything done is still a mystery to him. His own country only strode onto the world stage when the party took control in 1949. One party, one rule, one strong leader. That's how his grandfather went from being an illiterate soldier to a respected party official who even made it unscathed through the Cultural Revolution. Jiang checks his watch. Asim is late. Of course. The men from the Middle East he has dealt with over the years can kill children, blow up airliners, and slaughter customers at a shopping center, but they are unable to tell time or keep... The old man limps by and turns and shoves against Jiang's side, dropping his fishing pole. Something hard is digging into Jiang's ribs.
"Hello, my old Chinese friend," Asim al-Rashid says.
Asim smiles in pleasure at seeing the shocked look on the Chinaman's face. Asim respects the man's money and weapons, but that is about it. He is a smooth-handed and smooth-faced functionary. That is all. Definitely not a warrior who has had to wash the blood of his enemies off his clothes. And Jiang barely noticed Asim when he drove up in the smelly pickup truck, the one he and his cousin took 2 days ago after killing the cigarette smugglers in the woods over in Vermont State. With old clothes, pebbles in his shoes to make him limp, a stretch of tape across his shoulders to make him hunchbacked, and a smear of color across his eyebrows to make them look gray, he fooled this intelligence officer. Asim pulls his pistol back.
"I am here, Jiang Lijun. Don't look so surprised, and don't waste my time. What do you want?"
The Chinaman quickly recovers, smiles, lights up a cigarette without offering one to Asim, who ignores the insult. Jiang says,
"Congratulations, Asim. One professional to another. This has been one impressive operation. It must have taken years of preparation. Quite admirable."
"Thank you," Asim says. "My contacts and networks are well paid, well prepared, and have been in place for years. And they always respond to my requests, whether it's for weapons, money, or transportation."
"But what now, Asim?"
"You know of my demands."
Jiang shrugs.
"Nonsense, and you know it. If you get your demands and release the girl, the Americans will chase you down to the ends of the globe and kill you. And if you don't receive your demands and kill the girl, they will do the same, only quicker. The Americans are a soft-hearted and soft-headed bunch. Killing a girl will only enrage them."
The Chinaman takes another drag of his cigarette.
"Well?"
Asim says, "My plans are mine. And what are yours?"
Jiang drops the cigarette on the ground, grinds it with the heel of his shoe.
"Officially, I'm here to ask you, as a courtesy and a favor, to release the girl to me. It removes a dangerous burden from you, and it assists my government in improving relations with the United States. In return, we'll be quite generous in rewarding you and your cousin. A nice cash payment, and relocation to any safe place on the globe. Even China."
Asim smiles, shakes his head.
"Would you transport us then to Xinjiang province, where we would live among our cousins, the Uyghurs? Would we then be placed into camps, re-educated, forced to work in slave labor factories?"
The Chinaman remains quiet, stoic. Asim says,
"You said, officially. Is there an unofficial position?"
Jiang looks out across the quiet pond.
"Yes."
"And?"
A long pause, as though Jiang is considering what to say next. His voice softens.
"I want you to succeed, whatever you're planning to do," Jiang says. "I can provide you with funds, means of transportation, weapons, some intelligence on what the Americans are up to. Whatever it takes for you to humiliate this nation, I am on your side."
Asim ponders this.
"Why would you do this for me?"
"My business," Jiang says. "And I have put my career and life in jeopardy by making this offer to you. Remember that, because I won't forget."
Asim picks up the fishing pole, starts back to the truck.
"I will remember your exposure, and I will consider your generous and unofficial offer. Thank you for the visit, old friend. Let us remain in touch."
Jiang opens the door to his car.
"Yes, let's."
10 minutes later, Jiang is driving along the country road when he rounds a corner and approaches a police roadblock. There are police cruisers and a wooden barricade painted orange, and officers in black jumpsuits and helmets with automatic weapons. Jiang slows down his rental GMC, lowers the window. Two men approach. One comes up to the door, the other stands back, covering him with an automatic rifle. "License and registration, sir?" the closer man asks. His face is flushed, eyes red-rimmed as if he has worked too many hours without rest. "Absolutely, sir," Jiang says. He hands over the car's rental paperwork and his license. The officer gives it a good look. You're a Canadian citizen, Mr. Yang?
I am.
Do you have your passport with you?
Absolutely,
Jiang says.
A moment, please.
He hands over his dark blue passport, its cover emblazoned with the seal of Canada, along with passport, passeport, in bright yellow letters. The officer says,
Business in New Hampshire, Mr. Yang?
I'm traveling to Boston, he says, thinking he's on that tightrope once more, and all is well. I work for Resolute Forest Products in Montreal, and I'm making sales calls to a number of businesses in Manchester and Boston. Would you like to see my business card?
A shake of the head and his passport and paperwork are returned.
Not necessary. Could you open the trunk, please?
Of course.
He releases the toggle to the trunk, and some other officers inspect it. The armed man near him produces two photos and says,
Have you seen either of these two men in your travels? Please look closely.
Jiang keeps his face bland as he looks over the color photos of Asim al-Ashid and his cousin, Faraj. One of them with a beard, one of them clean-shaven. A thought comes to him. He could tell these men that he saw Asim in that pickup truck. Provide them with the license plate, and within minutes, a cordon would be drawn up and then hundreds, if not thousands, of police, government, and military searchers would flood this area. And Asim would be captured. And the girl would be freed, and Jiang would have accomplished his mission. His official mission. He would be congratulated, receive a promotion and citations, and perhaps relations would improve between his homeland and this unvirtuous country. But his unofficial mission is more near and dear to him.
For you, father, he thinks, and for you as well, daughter.
He smiles.
No, sir, I have not seen these two men.
Very well, the officer says, stepping away, motioning for Jiang's trunk to be shut and the barrier to be moved. Other cars have lined up behind Jiang. You're free to go.
Thank you,
Jiang says.
And to himself, he says, Cao ni ma, you and this entire foul place.
Chapter 48 Saunders Hotel, Arlington, Virginia. After I disconnect my call to Saudi Arabia, I wait for a minute before attempting my second overseas phone call. Samantha, bless her, still seems to be sleeping, and I quietly walk over to Agent Stahl, typing away on his government-issue laptop at a round table on this side of the suite. I need him to check something out. Keeping my voice low, I say, David.
Sir?
Tell me, do you have contacts in the Treasury Department? David lifts his head. His hair is in disarray, face pale, eyes swollen and tired.
Certainly, sir.
There's that fund in the Treasury Department. The Judgment Fund, I say, drawing on my memories as a congressman serving on the Financial Services Committee. It's a quick and easy way for the president to transfer funds like Bitcoin for the payment of Mel's ransom.
Sounds familiar, sir, Agent Stahl says, stifling a yawn.
Reach out to your contacts, I say. Find out what progress is being made to prepare the Bitcoin payment. I check my watch, my heart feeling like lead. Just 7 more hours before the ransom deadline. David says, on it, sir. I go back to my work area, check on Samantha, still sleeping. I hope she won't remember whatever dreams she might be having. I go to my iPhone, dial another number, and it goes to voicemail.
This is Palumbo, says the familiar voice. You know the drill.
Yes, I think I certainly know the drill. The Deputy National Security Advisor for the National Security Council isn't answering my calls. The next call goes more smoothly and is answered on the second ring. Mr. President, says the voice, with an accent that has a touch of Brooklyn in Hebrew. It belongs to Danny Cohen, the retired head of Israel's Mossad. I was expecting your call. How are you and your dear wife holding up?
As well as can be expected, I say.
We're in a hotel suite across the river from D.C., trying to keep on top of developments. And Danny, how's retirement treating you?
A soft laugh.
Nice, in a way, when your biggest problem of the day is getting a replacement pump for your irrigation system so your orange grove doesn't dry out. But you have not called to check in on my retirement. What can I do for you, Mr. President?
First, call me Matt, I say. Second, I know there are official communications and information sharing going on between Langley and Tel Aviv. But is there anything you may be hearing unofficially that can be of use? I just can't sit back and just hope everything works out, Danny. Danny says, Asim al-Ashid has always been a tough man, Matt. I know, I say. A freelance terrorist with no ties to a nation state, like one of those evil types Ian Fleming used to come up with back when things were simpler, but with a worldwide network of supporters. A good analogy, Matt, Danny says. Our people are working very, very hard to come up with anything solid, trying to see if we have anything that traces Asim's travels to the United States and your home. But he and his cousin, they work diligently, using cutouts and false identities. They're cold and cunning, with quiet allies across the world. But the work still goes on from Tel Aviv, I can promise you that. Many favors are being called in, and pressure is being applied. I nod. Mossad is legendary for its intelligence work and operations for good reason. From the beginning, a precondition of Israel's survival has been knowing what their neighbors are up to. Then, as more and more Jews came as refugees and migrants to Israel from countries like Russia and Kazakhstan, Morocco and Ethiopia, the U.S. and Canada, Israel was able to develop back channels and direct information gathering networks, not just in its region, but in nations across the world, including those publicly wishing for its death. If any intelligence agency can catch a scent of Asim al-Ashid's travels, it will be Danny Cohen's old haunt. Thank you, Danny, I say. From the other side of the room, I hear Agent Stahl talking to someone via his phone. I wish I could do more, Matt, Danny says with sympathy. And I wish you could have done more when you were in the White House. You inherited a tough situation, but I believe you would have accomplished a lot more in the second term, which your vice president's betrayal denied you. Danny is being over-generous. Presidents before me have tried to settle the thorny issues dividing Israelis and Palestinians, and future presidents will keep trying. The formula for success sounds simple. Land for peace, land for an independent Palestinian state, security guarantees for Israel. It's like the old joke about how to make elephants stew. Step one, boil a large pot of water. Step two, get an elephant. Though the violence between Israel and the Palestinians has been reduced, the possibility of peace that once seemed so close has dimmed. The continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank leaves less land for a Palestinian state, and the rise of Iran and its so-called Shia Crescent, stretching across parts of Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain, has driven Israel closer to the Sunni Arab states, which care more about their economic and security relationships with Israel than about solving the Palestinian problem. These factors, plus the iron grip of Hamas and the Palestinians in Gaza for more than a decade, will bedevil whoever occupies the Oval Office. Danny knows all of that better than I do, of course. I did what I could with the time I had, I say, which wasn't much. One of these days, if peace does break out, I'll be just a footnote, if that. Danny knows that, too. What matters to him is that he was sure of my commitment to Israel's security. With the current administration, he isn't so sure. He really wants to help. You are a good man, Mr. President, and bless you and Samantha and Mel, Danny says. I will contact you if I learn anything, anything at all. As I disconnect the call with the old Mossad leader, I hear a muffled curse behind me and turn. Agent Stahl is at his laptop. The bastards. The cold-hearted bastards, he whispers. I go over to him. David? Tears are in his eyes. Nothing, he says, voice rising. Nothing! There's no movement, no plans, no procedures in place to get that Bitcoin ready to be transferred. Nothing, Mr. President. A sob comes from behind me. I turn. Samantha's sitting up on the bed, hand to her face. I was right, Matt. I was right. They're not going to get our daughter back, are they? I try not to lose my temper. No, they're not. There are tears in her eyes, but her voice is strong and firm. Matt, what are we going to do? I look to Agent Stahl, and then to my duffel bag filled with arms and ammunition, and I'm fully alert, aware, all senses tingling, like I'm about to step into a Black Hawk in the middle of the night, ready to strike at whatever enemy is out there. Whatever it takes, I say. We're getting Mel back.
Chapter 49. Monmouth, New Hampshire. Officer Corinne Bradford is lying on her stomach in a copse of woods and low brush, keeping view on the large house below her, about 100 feet away. The ground is cold and moist against her chilled skin as she brings up the binoculars again, scanning the quiet yard. It's a cold morning, and she's hoping against hope that this little thread, this little clue, will work out. The previous several hours were spent going up and down Route 113, stopping at every farm stand, service station, and little shop, showing off the photo of the Cadillac Escalade snapped from the Citizens Bank CCTV system, and telling everyone it was a confidential investigation so word wouldn't get back to her idiot chief. At RJ's Hardware, at last, she got a hit.
"Sure," Bing Torrance, the store's manager, said an hour ago. "I saw something like that go up the dirt road to the Macomber place the other day. I know they've been renting it off and on for years, but I thought it was weird to see a strange vehicle there, 'cause they haven't rented their place in over a year."
So here she is, cold, thirsty, what she wouldn't do for a coffee and a breakfast sandwich from McDonald's, or two. Corinne checks her watch. In an hour, she's due to report to work at the police station. Should she go to work and tell Chief Grambler what she's found out? Sure. Some hardware guy thought he saw a Cadillac Escalade go up to this house, and I've kept watch on it for a couple of hours and haven't seen a light, a person, or anything. And Chief Grambler will probably fire her cold ass for insubordination. Corinne brings up the binoculars again. An impressive two-story wooden house, dark brown, with a detached three-car garage. Pricey. Behind the house, the well-mowed lawn goes down to a large, isolated pond, and there's a fixed dock going out into the water. Another check of the watch, and Corinne thinks, "Damn it, no matter what, I'm not moving. I'll call in sick or something. But nope, I'm staying right here." Corinne lowers the binoculars again, rubs at her tired and cold eyes. Hot coffee. Why in the world didn't she come up here prepared with a thermos and maybe... The sound of an engine snaps her right out of it. The binoculars are back in her hands. Her heart is slamming right along. There's an open stretch just before the garage where there's a good view. And something is coming up the dirt road, engine getting louder. "Damn," she whispers. Not a Cadillac Escalade. A battered old black pickup truck. Ford. "Damn," she whispers again. All this time, all this waiting, her clothing soaked through and cold, just to see an old black Ford pickup truck. The middle garage door quietly slides up, and the pickup truck goes into the empty bay. Hold it. Hold on. She tries to steady her breathing, the shake starting in her wrists and hands. In the left bay of the garage is a black Cadillac Escalade. The hardware guy was right. She waits, takes deep breaths. Movement. A man comes out of the garage as the door slowly descends behind him. He has a dull yellow coat over his arm, and he's rubbing at his forehead with a cloth. And when he lowers the cloth, Corinne almost gasps. It's the terrorist kidnapper, Asim al-Ashid, right here in front of her. Corinne picks up the binoculars, slowly moves back down into a thicket of trees, pulls out her phone. No service. Damn it all to hell. That's one thing that she hasn't gotten used to. The many areas up here where there is no cell tower service. It's as if she's been cast back into the 1990s. Corinne looks back at where she's come from. Her 9mm Sig Sauer is holstered at her side. She's convinced, deep in her bones, that the president's daughter is up at that house. Should she try to rescue her? Now? Corinne hates herself, but no,
That would be suicide. She's got to contact... who? Chief Grambler? No. That idiot would argue, dismiss, and poo-poo what she's found out. Time to think of someone else. And pray that she gets cell service. A few minutes later, praise the Lord, she gets cell service, and she searches through her contacts until she finds the listing for Clark Yates, who used to be with her in the Massachusetts State Police and who lucked out by jumping over to the New Hampshire State Police before the Great Purge began. The phone rings. 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 Pick up, pick up, pick up, she whispers. Hello? She sags in relief. Clark, it's Corinne Bradford. Corinne? Damn, it's early. I mean, Clark, she interrupts. You've got to help me. I know where the president's daughter is located. I've found the kidnapper and seen his vehicle. Corinne, are you sure? And why are you telling me? Shouldn't you... Yeah, I know, she says, glancing around at the trees, exposed granite boulders and underbrush. But my chief is an idiot. Look, consider this a solid tip. In northern Monmouth, on a dirt road marked with a wooden sign that says McCumber, off Route 113, just past RJ's Hardware, at the end of the dirt road is a two-story country-style house with a large pond at the rear. Corinne, I saw him. I saw the damn terrorist kidnapper, Clark, and the Cadillac Escalade, honest to God. She hears something rustling out there. Probably the wind moving the tall trees back and forth, rubbing against each other. Clark says, okay, got it. I'll start making calls. I hope to God you're right. Me too, she says. Me too. Bye for now. Don't let me down. Corinne disconnects her call, and there's a snap, like a stick being cracked. She looks behind her, at the man she saw outside the garage, coming toward her with a knife in his hand, smiling with quiet confidence.